Welcome to another episode of Let There Be Talk. Today, what is it? Labor Day, September 1st. The rent is due. Happy Labor Day. This episode's late, obviously, because it's Labor Day. No. actually, I'm just getting this up because I just got in from Denver, Colorado. If any of you out there listening to me brand new from seeing me in Denver all weekend, welcome. You guys absolutely kick ass. You guys kick ass. Freaking dumb. You guys kick ass. Denver. Denver rocked, man. A lot of people say the Comedy Works is one of the best clubs in America. I'm saying absolutely. I haven't done a lot of clubs, but out of the ones I've done, holy shit, man, that place is amazing. Shout out to the staff, everyone at the Comedy Works, some of the coolest people I've ever met that work at a club. Sometimes you'd be at a club and the people are just like, I hate my job, but everybody there, man, just great. Sound was great, the room was cool, it was like a mini theater. And the reason I was there was, first of all, let me just say that this weekend was probably one of the most epic weekends I've ever had in my life. I've done a lot of cool shit, but Russell Peters invited me to come feature for him in Denver a couple months ago. And, you know, I was fired up. I couldn't wait. And the show has finally come. And I can't even tell you how cool this guy is as a human. If you don't know who Russell Peters is, I didn't a couple years ago. He was on my podcast. I had him on. Please listen to the episode. Let me find what episode it was here for you guys. I never have my shit together. You go, come on, man, get your shit together. Where was it? Nah, I gotta find it. Anyway, it's on here. It's on here. It's on Let There Be Talk. Find the Russell Peters episode. Anyway, I meet him a couple years ago at the Laugh Factory. I didn't know who he was. And a friend of mine said, oh, that guy's like one of the biggest international comedians in the world. I'm like, really? I YouTube him. I start laughing. I go, man, this guy's fucking funny. He invites me over a couple years ago to his house for Thanksgiving. I don't have family in L.A. An epic day with his family, you know, just so generous and cool. And then we become friends. Mutual love of metal. We're around the same age. We grew up in the same era of metal and early hip-hop. A lot of people think I don't like hip-hop. I always say, yes, I do. I like it when it was good. Public Enemy, NWA, you know, early rap, stuff that was radical and cutting edge. We hit it off right away and became friends, and man. So he takes me to Denver, and it's just epic. And his assistant, Eddie, just so cool. Just shout out to these guys. I'm stumbling from words because it was just, this shit was awesome, man. These guys are so nice. You just hope to get somewhere in your career to where you could be like Russell and just help people out and just be cool, man. I mean, you know, I've been lucky to be around cool people in this comedy world, you know. Bill Burr, Mary Lynn, I was talking about her last week. Russell, Ian, Eric Griffin, Jay Moore. I mean, all these guys are just, they're just solid people, man. So, you know, Russell, please follow him on Twitter. Tell people about him. Become a fan. The guy is fantastic. He's crazy funny. He's going out to do his fourth special. He's going to tour for the next 2 years the entire world. This guy does everywhere. He sold out the O2 Arena in London. I was there with the Stones. You know how big that joint is? He is doing Madison Square Garden. This is the level this guy is. He was a member. He was a judge on this year's Last Comic Standing. But he's way more than that, man. I'm going to open for him. He asked me to feature for him at the Nokia on November 8th. That's going to be 9,000 people. The biggest show I've done. I can't believe it. Thank you, Russell. I love you and I owe you, man. And I can't thank you enough. This weekend in Denver was just, if I didn't do comedy again, that'd be it. It'd be like, yeah, I did it. But, you know, after that weekend, it makes you want to, you can see, you just go, God, this is, comedy just gets so great out there. The fans and I'm just babbling now because I was just happy, man. Thank you, Russell. And thanks everybody for tuning in. How you guys been? You had a great weekend? I saw Soundgarden a few nights ago at the Hollywood Bowl. Fuck. They ruled. Hats off to Soundgarden. I didn't get to see Nine Inch Nails. I had to do a show. That's the sacrifice. But I got to see Soundgarden. And the set list was phenomenal. Thank God, man. Soundgarden, it was great. It was like, you coming to see us? We're not going to just play some later hits. We're going to go. They went deep. They played shit from the first record. They played stuff from Ultra Mega OK. They played a lot of stuff from Bad Motor Finger, which was unbelievable. And Chris sounded great. The band was great. A lot of people were ripping on him on Twitter when I was saying I was seeing him, like shoegazers. Oh, those guys look like they're doing it for the money. You guys are morons. YouTube Soundgarden. I saw them back in the day. That's how they've always been. They're not cashing in, man. That's how they play. They stand in one spot. That's how shoegazers, that's the term came from all those grunge guys. It was not cool to jump around and be like, you know, David Lee Roth. You had to be like, I'm hurting with pain up here, man. I'm in pain. I'm a man in the box. It's not Soundgarden, but you get the idea. And that reminds me of my guest today, Sammy Obaid, comedian, good friend of mine. Very funny, dude. We get into some grunge talk. Not only that, though, I'll tell you who Sammy Obaid is. Sammy Obaid, I met about my first year in comedy. He said he was going to do 1,000 shows in a row, not miss a day. And at first I was like, yeah, that sounds kind of hokey. But then as I started seeing Sammy everywhere, I go, oh, shit, this guy's, it's not a gimmick. He's doing it. And he started filming it, and now he's got a documentary film going to come out. But he does 1,000 days of comedy in a row. And I think I've done 1,000, but not a, I missed like 4 days. So damn it, you got me, Sammy. But that's incredible, 1,000 days. And at the end of the 1,000 days, he does Conan O'Brien. So you've got to hear this story. It's so good. And anybody that's always looking for the fucking secret back door or how to get famous quick, what shoulder do I rub? Whose dick do I suck? You don't. There's no magic in comedy except hard work. And if you look at the hard workers, you see they're getting something. You know what I mean? You got like a D'Elia. Guy worked his ass off. Sammy, you got, who else you got? You got, man, my brain is fried. Just anybody that in comedy, that if you look at somebody that's famous, they did, there's no shortcuts. It's not like, oh, yeah, he had this or that. I'm so tired of hearing people, oh, he had that or this. Fuck you. These guys did the work, man. They go, they drive around, no money, do these shitty little spots, you know, work right, go back, sleep, work right, perform. It's just like, it's just, that's all it is. It's a blur. And then one day you hope you start getting somewhere. And that's where Sammy got, man. Hard work paid off. He stepped on that stage at Conan. I was there that day. And, man, we were all proud. We were like, look, that guy's doing Conan. So hats off. Sammy obeyed. After the episode, look him up. Say hi to him on Twitter. This week, real quick, before we split, I'm going to be at the Hollywood Improv with my main man, Jay Moore. Hey, man, shoot it! Thursday, Hollywood Improv, 8 o'clock, and I'll be on Wednesday morning on Jay Moore Sports on Fox. So tune in. We'll be dicking off on there, having fun. Jay Moore Sports on Fox Wednesday. And then this weekend, I'm going to be headlining Arizona. Come out to Scottsdale to the Comedy Spot. Don't be missing this, fools. Tell your friends. 5th and 6th, Scottsdale. And then on the way home, I'm going to interview Chris Goss from Masters of Reality. That's going to be cool. So great weekend coming up. Episodes brought to you by my good friends, Earthquaker Devices. Sammy talks about playing guitar on here and Jimi Hendrix and stuff. You know, Earthquaker Devices makes the greatest guitar pedals going. Get yourself one. Tune in. EarthquakerDevices.com. Check out their pedals. They're all handmade right in Akron, Ohio. And their website is EarthquakerDevices.com. Foot pedals. Boutique foot pedals. You're going, what the fuck's a foot pedal? You ever hear like any kind of fuzz, like Hendrix used pedals galore? Any modern day bands, U2. No foot pedals, no U2. Which is funny. Oh, fuck, I forgot to tell you, speaking of U2, while I was in Denver, we went down to Red Rocks. And I'd been to Red Rocks years ago, but at night, and I didn't get to see the whole magnitude of Red Rocks. And, you know, year after year, Red Rocks is an amphitheater in Denver that wins the number one amphitheater every year because it's just fucking insane. You got to go out there, man. I you know, I think once a year I'd like to just find my favorite band that's on tour that year and just fly and see them at Red Rocks instead of anywhere else. Fuck it. Make it a weekend or whatever night it is and go see a band at Red Rocks. This place is spectacular, which, by the way, the Oddball Comedy Tour is going out there. Please go see it if you're in Denver. Go see the Oddball Comedy Fest. Some of the best comedians in the planet on that thing. Marin's going to be on it. Louis C.K., Sarah Silverman. You know, numerous people look at it. Oddball. Brody Stevens is the host out there. You got it. Love you, Brody. But go to Red Rocks, man. The reason I brought it up was, remember U2 had that Sunday Bloody Sunday video was shot there. And, you know, I remember a famous Pearl Jam show from there. Just Red Rocks. Look, Google it, man. I tweeted some photos of it, too. It'll blow your mind. Anyway, Earthquaker Devices, guitar pedals. Get yourself one. Tell them Dean sent you. They'll hook you up. And also, don't forget, Harley Davidson, my boys McGuire, Harley Davidson, they sponsor the podcast. Love them. I'm going to be doing their grand opening September 20th during the day, 11 to 3, I think it is. That's going to be killer. They're going to have a Van Halen tribute band out there. I'm going to jump up and sing one with them. Might as well jump. McGuire Harley Davidson, go check them out. They got the brand new 2015s coming in. I just looked at the new Harleys. They just came out on Monday. And man, they're badass. They got the Road Glide back. Go see Ryan at McGuire and ask him about the 2015s. I'm loving the Road King out of the whole lineup. Road King rocks. Road King is the secret Harley Superbike, I think. McGuire, love you guys. McGuire Harley Davidson, check him online, McGuire-HD.com, or on Twitter. Say hi to Ryan. They'll give you some sweet hookups. And see me there September 20th. Thanks for tuning in, guys. I miss all you guys. Great to hear from you. Got all kinds of good emails. Oh, shit. Someone gave me a donation, man. And let's see. Hold on. All right. I got it here. That would have been a crime not to give this guy a shout out. John Glavin. Thank you, buddy. Donating to the podcast. Says, love your work ethic. It's a huge inspiration to me. Keep doing what you do. Here's a tiny little donation. Thank you, man. You rock, John. And wherever you live, free tickets on me. Just hit me, email me when I come to your town. I love you, buddy. And I love all the Del Razors. Light the candles of rock. Here he is, Sammy Obeid. Hey, what's happening? Here's another episode of Let There Be Talk. Got a great guest today, good friend of mine, comedian Sammy Obeid. How are you, buddy?
Hey, I'm doing great, man, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, welcome, man.
Thank you.
We've been trying to get you on for about a year.
Yeah, we've been talking about it, and then we finally made it happen.
Well, we were going to do it right before you did Conan. And then it just got too scrambled.
Because we were too busy partying backstage, you know what I mean?
Yeah, we were, boy, eating that salami and caramel corn.
You sit in the massage chairs, too?
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah, that was great, man.
An hour I sat in that thing.
We were all just living off the land that day, man.
Looked like the homeless crew took over.
Yeah, it was like a comic's dream for all of us. We were like, this is great.
It's funny, because I've gone many times with Ian to Conan when he shoots. And I keep telling myself, I'll know exactly how to do it once I'm on Conan.
Yeah.
But when I go with when I went with Ian a few times, really mellow, Ian gets ready, and then the show starts. But you came with a gang of dudes.
And then I don't know if you remember, like right before I went on, I was like jumping around everywhere.
Yeah.
I was taking like a platter of fruits. And I have the thing where I get the dry mouth right before I go on stage. If I'm any bit nervous, I'll get that dry mouth.
Yeah, cotton.
So I was like, So I was like, I'm going to grapes, apples, oranges. I put them all in a bag. I'm like, one of these is going to get my, you know what I mean?
Yep.
And none of them were working.
Let's back it up a little bit. We met, I've been doing comedy now for years and around 8 months.
Has it been 4 years?
Oh yeah, I'm coming on five. Like I think November 26th will be five years.
Time flies. I remember right like when you were like 2 years in.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, and I was like, damn, Dean Delray is 2 years in and he's already in every club. You know what I mean?
That's how we met. And how long were you doing comedy when I met you?
I think I was about 4 years in.
Okay, four years in.
I think I started like 2 years before you, or two and a half years before you, something like that.
Interesting story about Sammy. He decides to do 1,000 days of comedy. And I remember when I first heard about it, I was like, that sounds like some kind of gimmick, you know, 1,000 days of comedy, you know, and so I'm kind of not really paying much attention to it. But then I start realizing, hey, this guy's serious. He's great comedian, cool friend. And we start seeing each other everywhere.
It's crazy because I met you when I'd started. Like I was like 30 days into it.
Yeah.
And I was moving to LA and you were running three clubs.
That's right.
And we started both having slots at three clubs. You were doing the early slot and I was doing the later slot.
That's right, because Swinehart had given me the open mic.
Yes.
And he said, hey, you can have this. Yes. I'm burnt on it.
Yes.
And then you would do the 10 o'clock show after.
Yes.
And that's really, I think, where I started meeting a lot of people and getting friends.
Me too, for LA. I think that's the interesting thing. I think we both got our LA network started around the same time I moved, and we were both doing three clubs.
And it felt like such a cool tree fort. Like, get three of clubs, if you don't know, if you're not from LA,
it's got history. It's been in Swingers.
Swingers.
Yeah.
And it really feels, you and I are from the Bay Area, it really feels San Francisco.
It feels San Francisco.
Me.
It's got a rock and roll vibe with the, like, you know, like
the big booths.
Yeah, exactly.
It's dark. It feels like if you've drank at Murillo's Trophy Room on Haight Street, not mm-hmm. the remodeled Murillo's, yes. which blew my mind. It was horrible.
It's like Club Deluxe a lot, too.
It's a lot, you know, like Club Deluxe.
Yeah.
You go in, it's dark. They have probably one of the top three jukeboxes in LA.
It's solid. And then
you open this side door, and it's like a mini theater club. Like,
and it's soundproof, too, which is amazing.
That's crazy.
That's so rare to find in a bar, a soundproofed room. It's like a recording studio in the back of a bar.
Yeah.
That's how thick the walls are.
So you got this full-blown jukebox, day drinking rummy bar, and then in the other room, a badass comedy show going on.
It's so cool. And Swinehart has basically been the father of this room for, a decade probably almost.
Yeah, he's even taken it back recently.
Yeah, he's taken it back. And we're talking about trying to revive, put on another show. I mean, maybe we should do something there too.
I would love to do that, yeah, man. Because
that'd be so easy. Yeah. I mean, we could make that happen just like that.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
And it's such a great vibe.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they got a DJ there. They got an oil painting of Billy D. Williams with a Colt 45.
They got drink specials every night.
Yeah. And they tore down, I don't know if you saw that, but about a week ago, they tore down that crack hotel next to the liquor store.
No, really?
I can't believe it.
Oh, that's great news.
That's great news.
I didn't know.
Because, boy, was
it. The corner, that's the only thing about that place. The corner's kind of sketchy, and there's not foot traffic there. It's like, if you're going there, it's because you're going to three clubs.
Yeah,
you're
right.
You're not just passing by going to the gas station.
I got news for anybody that's not from Hollywood. Boy, anything that's ghetto, I've noticed lately, they're just tearing it down. Because it's going San Fran style. East Hollywood is all converting into hipster, money and good stores and stuff. A lot of people would say, oh, that's bullshit. But to me, I'm down with it because the crime on that corner was fierce.
Yeah, it's like a rough corner in the midst of, Hollywood, which is all kind of, posh and.
Yeah, yeah. Hollywood's pretty damn nice.
Yeah.
Two blocks up, you got the new Walgreens and Shop House and the Arclight and Chipotle and everything.
Right.
And then, just just gangster. And that's where Pacquiao trains, right?
Yeah, in that little studio back behind Three Clubs. That's the crazy thing about that corner. It's got the Pacquiao's whole crew hangs out there.
Yeah, and it's so cool. Like, he'll come in. He's like Rocky, living in America.
Yeah, yeah,
he'll
be
throwing money out at the neighborhood kids and shit. I remember one time I went up in there to box. I was like, I'm going to start boxing in here. And I signed up.
Yeah?
It was like, I don't know.
Do you have to take a class or something?
No, you go in and just train. It's a gym in there.
Just start boxing and hitting
the bags. Yeah, you just run bags and shit. So I go in, I put some gloves on, and I remember when I took them off, my hands smelt like nothing I can even compare it to. If you took four homeless guys' shoes and just chewed on them a while. I had to ride home with my motorcycle, put gloves on. I didn't want to put them on because they would destroy my gloves. So I rode home, no gloves. My hands just stinking.
That's how you know Pacquiao's tough, man. He trains that dirty,
old roach corner there.
He's ready for anything.
So we meet there and you start up the 1,000 days. Now, what people don't understand, it's 1,000 days straight of comedy.
1,000 days. And that wasn't the plan in the beginning. The plan was just, I'm going to do comedy as many nights in a row and take as little nights off as possible, which is something you do.
Right, exactly.
And you're one of the few people who does that, too. I mean, I'd say throughout, if I did a tally of every person I saw throughout the 1,000 days and who I saw most consistently, especially if we just focus on L.A., it's like you would be number one. For sure. I saw you everywhere. You know what I mean?
Well, that's how I started thing, this guy's serious and this is cool. Like, it would be like me, you, Gerard Carmichael.
Yeah.
Probably those are the three that I would see everywhere.
Yeah, totally, totally. And so that's why I saw a lot of you really fast when I, started moving to LA. And I just originally just wanted to do as many days as possible, and I was like, all right, I'm gonna do 365. Then I got to 365, and I had heard someone had done more than a year before, so I was like, all right, well, I have to just go as far as I can. I set 1,000 days and did it, which turns out to be 2.75 years.
Yeah.
So not only did I meet you at the beginning of that, but over the course of that, we ended up doing like a shitload of shows together, San Francisco.
Yeah.
Your return to San Francisco with the Punchline.
That was great. We became comedians on this run.
Exactly. Yeah.
We really did because it was amazing. We would see each other. We'd trade stories like, where were you? I was over here last night. Over here, it'd be like, oh, God, this was terrible or whatever. But not only are you doing 1,000 days straight, but you're like me. You're doing 2-3 in a night.
Yeah, exactly.
So while you were doing 1,000 days straight, I was doing I was going straight through too, but with a zillion spots.
Yeah, you had a lot of good spots locked. I'd always be like, you know, like I just hit the haha. I'm just doing the Comedy Store now. I'm at the Laugh Factory. Like you're, I'm like you're getting some good quality. You got a good couple good quality 7 minute spots.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a great night right there.
Yeah, that is a great night, man. You're doing 21 minutes total in three rooms.
Yeah, dude, man, that's how you do it.
Now, what were the criteria for the 1,000 days? Was there you had to do a certain amount of minutes?
Yeah, so I kind of said I had to set certain criteria based on what was reasonable, what I thought was reasonable, and what I thought was, you know, possible. So first of all, I set the basic minimum of a set at 3 minutes because say you get up in the OR at the store,
that's
you know
a
what
spot.
I mean? It's a spot.
Yeah.
You know, they'll always give you your 3 minutes. Yeah. You know, sometimes you can push it to 3:34, whatever.
Yeah.
Depending on how ballsy you are, you're the star.
Somebody's on the phone, right. Looking at the light. I guess you might get seven. Two sets.
But yeah, so 3 minutes I said to the basic, because there were some nights where it's just like, I can't get up anywhere else. Or you're in New York, and it's like the only thing you can get is a 3 minute spot. You got to count that.
Yeah.
You know, treat it like a spot.
That's funny because, I've done almost 2,500 spots now.
Right.
And people go, well, what counts as a spot?
Right.
And I go, well, I mean, at the beginning, getting on stage counts as a fucking spot.
Exactly.
That's
exactly.
One spot more than you're doing.
Yeah, exactly. And the rule is, okay, so yeah, you have to have a microphone perform a show unless it's understood that it's a comedy show without a microphone, which there are.
Sometimes
you'll be at a small theater
or the mic
breaks, Ice House open mic, you're talking to a crowd. You're still doing comedy.
Yeah, you are.
Or say you're on a stage with a mic, you know,
clip
to your thing. It's the same thing.
Yep.
You're using your hands in the same way. So those instances have to count, obviously, too. But otherwise, you know, to have a mic there to signify that it is a show when people are there sitting in the crowd. But that's rule number. That's the third rule, which is the most important, is that it has to be understood that it's a comedy show.
Right.
Like, I can't just grab a mic, run on the street, and start talking to people. That's not a comedy show.
Yeah,
that's not fair.
Right.
That would be cheating.
Yeah.
But you have to, like, so, for instance, there was a time where I went on a retreat at this cabin, and I said, I can only go on the retreat if you let me perform. This was with my girlfriend at the time and her friends. If you let me perform for everybody.
Right.
We didn't have a mic or a sound system, but we set it up as a show. They all sat down, like, isn't we're a theater?
Yeah.
And I did a 10-minute set.
Now, there was another time, too, where you looked like you weren't going to get a spot, and you just kind of mobbed a karaoke bar, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about
So the first time, this was all in San Francisco. In San Francisco, on a Sunday, there's only one place to get up. That's the San Francisco Punchline, the showcase.
Yep.
And if you don't get up, it's like you don't have any other choices. So one night, this happened three times. The first night, I couldn't get up on the Sunday showcase, so I went frantically looking around San Francisco. And I went to this place called Ray's Hearth. You know Ray's Hearth?
I don't.
It's a bar in the Inner Richmond.
Okay, yeah, that's where I live. 10th and Cabrillo.
It's on Geary and like 6th or 11th. Geary and 11th.
Right, I got you.
11th Ave.
That's right by my house.
Yeah, I'm sure you've passed by.
Yeah.
And it's just it's a cool little bar owned by a nice guy, Ray. They had an open mic there for a while. But I was like, I ran out of places like 11:45 at night. I'm like, I need to get up on stage before midnight. That was another rule, too.
Oh, yeah. Because it's a day-to-day
thing, yeah. So I went in there, and I was just like, hey, is Ray here? I need to ask if I can get up on this stage. And he was nice enough to set up his sound system and let me perform.
Yeah.
So that was great. Then a year later, the same thing happened. I didn't want to go bug Ray again.
Man.
So I went to this place called Ireland's 32.
Now I know
you know
that
where that
place.
Is.
Yeah.
That's on Geary and 3rd or 4th
or
something like that.
Yeah, it's like by the Craigan.
And that place is just notorious for being rowdy, and they had an open mic there. I got a shoe thrown at me once at the open mic.
Wow.
Yeah, two
a
shoes,
shoe?
Actually. Two shoes. One guy, he threw his first shoe, and then I held the shoe on stage, and then he just said, fuck, I pissed him off again. He threw his second one.
What were you doing to piss him off?
You know, he was drunk and heckling, and I was just engaging him. I was going back at him.
Yeah.
I was just like, you know, I was making fun of him. I was going racial. I was just like,
yeah.
Irish car bomb. I'm Middle Eastern. We invented bombs, motherfucker. And the crowd was like, yeah, woo! It's like fucking drunk, you know, a bunch of animals. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I was just feeding the animals their meat, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And going after him. And he got so pissed, he threw a shoe on the stage.
God, that's hilarious.
It dodged me, so I picked it up. I'm like, got it. All right. You're walking home with one shoe tonight.
Yeah.
And then he's just, he calmed down. He's like, damn it, I should calm down. And then I started going at it again and like said something that pissed him off. He's like, damn it. Pulled up his other shoe, threw it at me. And then I took that. And then finally I made him come apologize. And then he ended up giving me a hug and he started crying.
Oh my God.
But that's just another night at Islands 32.
Right. Right. Yeah, you know, that's right.
That happens on karaoke
night.
That's
just some Avenue drinking.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's how they do it over there. So one night, I can't get a show, so I go ask the DJs playing there. They canceled the open mic because it was so rowdy.
Right.
And so we said, hey, can we just let this guy do comedy, my friend Justin Harrison?
Oh, yeah.
He used to run it. So he was like, hey, man, can you just let my friend Sammy do 5 minutes of comedy? The guy was like, sure, turn off the karaoke. Everybody's just booing at me, just instantly. Boo, get the fuck off stage. I'm doing my jokes. I'm just trying to like go plow through it. I'm like, I'm going to do 5 minutes. I'm going to do my jokes. And every now and then, you know, somebody will laugh.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, one guy who was kind of consistently laughing the whole time while everybody else was saying, fuck you. He came up to me, gave me a fist bump, right? I gave him the fist bump, but then he punched me in the stomach, grabbed the mic, and threw it on the ground.
Really?
Yeah.
That's just fucking assault bomb.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. But you know what? I just done about 5 minutes. I was like, I'm done here. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Then the DJ just queued back up the music, and I was like, you know.
He just punched you in the stomach.
It was like, but at the same time, I was so scared earlier that night that I wasn't going to get on, and now it's 11:30. I'm feeling like victorious. The punch in the stomach, like, I didn't even register in my head. It was like a celebration punch.
Okay, we got a spot.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, one time you did an airport, is that right? You're at the airport?
No, that must be an urban myth. That never happened. Yeah.
Oh, I must have dreamed that.
Yeah,
I swear
maybe.
To God, I thought that you were at like Southwest. You needed to get a spot, and you just did a spot on their.
Oh my God, that would be hilarious if I taped something
like that.
I must
have dreamed that.
Yeah, you must have. You know, because there was times where I was trapped at the airport and wondering if I was going to make it to my destination city.
Right.
That happened a lot, but I always did. And there was one time where this was the very end, like day 970 something.
Yeah.
I'm closing on the finish and I'm on this college tour out in the Midwest.
Yep.
And I lose my driver's license on a plane. Oh. And see, when you do a college tour, you know, as you know, you go out there and you rent cars. You have to rent cars. You have to have a license to rent a car.
You do, yeah.
And I have to rent a car. I have to rent a car in like 20 cities upcoming in the next 3 weeks.
No ID.
And I have no ID. I have a passport so I can get on planes.
Right.
But I am carless when I get to places. And these aren't places you can just walk or take a bus from the city. These are out in the middle of nowhere.
Hell yeah.
So I lose my license. I'm flipping out. I like, you know, some guy says, well, we can go to like a local town and ask them if they can give you a replacement license to rent a car.
Uh-huh.
And no officer would do it.
Wow.
So now I'm like bumming rides from people. I'm taking Greyhounds to the main cities and having people pick me up from place to place.
Wow. How you doing that with Twitter?
Facebook and Twitter, but mostly Facebook. I would put it out there, and then people would be like, I'd be like, does anybody know anyone in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania? I'd be like, oh, I know so-and-so. I'm going to call him in a favor. But the story was easy to sell because it was like, this guy's doing 1,000. You have to help him out or you're going to fail this monumental event.
Yeah.
And he's going to be on Conan next month.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
So it kind of, that whole thing kind of helped me keep it intact, but it was just crazy how at the end of the streak that shit was happening. And it was like I had to make shift like 7 nights in a row.
Wow.
And it was so stressful and so hard, but I made it work every time. And other than that, like there's just those other makeshift shows that I had to do. Everything else.
Right.
And ended up working out.
Now, you filmed the whole thing, right?
I did. Not the whole thing. We started about midway through.
Midway through.
Because in the beginning, I didn't know I was doing a thing.
That's right.
I mean, how awesome would it have been to capture the whole thing? Like, I'm going to do this challenge. But nobody in their right mind can rightfully go out and do that challenge. I'm not saying that nobody's ever going to do 1,000 days. I'm sure somebody will.
Yeah, they'll try to beat it.
You know, have mercy on that person's soul. I would wish it upon my worst enemy. It was.
Well, the thing is that people are missing is if you were famous, you could do it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Because it would be easy. You'd have these comfortable, leisurely shows.
You got the dates all booked ahead of time.
Nobody's going to deny you a spot.
Right.
You know what I mean?
But when you're an open mic guy like we were, spots alone are impossible to get, let alone saying, I'm going to do 1,000 in a row. What you're really saying is people are going to give you 1,000 spots.
Yeah, exactly.
And now,
at least,
later on, people are like, oh, yeah, he's doing something. But the first 300, let's say,
right.
People are going to go, I don't give a fuck.
Yeah, what
about
is this?
Don't
even know. Yeah.
Who cares?
That was all on me to watch my schedule like a hawk, which is, it became an obsession that, like, that was the most stressful part. So it's like the stressful part wasn't just getting up and doing it. That was easy. Yeah. Like anybody can get up out of their, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
If you're a normal person, people work for 8 hours a day plus, you know what I mean? Yeah. We're just, it's not hard, the work at all, but like the stress of having to keep that intact.
Make sure you get and the spots. Risk.
Yeah. I mean, if you're famous, you'd be like, I'm going to arrange a 6 o'clock show, be in bed by 9 p.m. tonight with
how
the wife.
Fucking
you
easy.
Know what I mean?
Yeah. Easy. Yeah. I'm sure there's some guys that probably did like 1,000 in a row back in the day, like famous
right.
old school dudes like
right.
Don Rickles or something, you
right,
know?
Right, right, right.
Where you're just on the road forever. That's interesting, God. Man. So now you've got this thing we were talking last week. It's all, you're starting to edit it now.
Yes.
And you say, what do you got, a couple hundred hours?
Yes, for sure. I didn't ask them the full count. I'm going to ask her today. I'm going to meet with her after this. I'm curious. But I definitely say a couple hundred hours.
Yeah.
And then there's like clips that were taken, like video footage of me from before we started filming the documentary, but like stuff from stage.
Oh, that's great.
Which gives us more material to look back.
From the, like at the beginning.
Yeah, and also like my brief appearance on America's Got Talent. In yeah. one, like the 500s, I made it like a 8 second appearance on America's Got
oh,
Talent.
Oh, wow, I didn't
and
know
we can
that.
We can include that in the thing. It basically all you'll see of me is I do my joke for 8 seconds in Vegas, and then at the end a clip where Howard Stern is like, "You guys will not be going to New York," and then my face like dropping down.
what bit did you do on that?
It was this older bit that I have, and it's basically I just say, you know, I read that in this world, there's 1 billion people who each live on $1 a day.
Yeah.
Man, why can't one of them be my girlfriend? Take her to the dollar store. It's romantic, you know.
Yeah.
Choose
yeah.
anything you want, yeah. but just one. Just
yeah,
one,
there's a know. Bag of jerky there.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, you were telling me you looked at the footage and you said it's a pretty fucking dark documentary.
It's very dark. It's very dark. And I think as comedians would know, that what would you expect? But the thing is that we started filming like the latter third of the documentary,
right.
which is when I like a lot of things turned bad. Like for me, I went through a breakup. I was getting stressed out by everything. I was facing all like the hard realities of comedy. And not that I like was hoping to be more successful by then, but I got cut from America's Got Talent. Like they cut my whole set from the program.
Oh wow!
You know, they showed other people's auditions in their satellite cities.
Yeah,
they didn't show mine. They cut mine completely because it had the bear joke, which they said they pulled because it was like too racy.
Oh yeah,
but that's I ended up doing it on Conan.
Right, right. Yeah.
So it was like redemption.
The one about the racist stuff.
Yeah,
gotcha.
Yeah. So, and there was like another joke that I did. It was like a Jewish joke, but it was like Howard Stern, Howie Mandel, Sharon Osbourne are all Jewish, and they loved it. They all laughed. But yeah. like the network was like, we don't know yeah. if we can do this. They cut me from the program. So that's why when I did that stuff for Conan, it like felt like redemption. It was like,
well, that's why I love Conan because, you know, man, Ian just recently was on Ian Edwards.
Yeah, yeah. He's had a great set.
Yeah, and it
Killed
was
it.
One of the most – I was in the room when it went down.
Yeah.
It was one of the most edgy sets I've ever seen on TV.
Yeah, what did he close
it's
with?
The Martin Luther King one.
Yes, yes,
so
that was it. That
I
was
don't want to give the joke yeah. away because, yeah. But it's one of the edgiest jokes I've ever seen on TV, hands down.
And it killed. And
I was in the room and I saw the whole crowd go. I didn't know what set he was going to do because all week I didn't want to know because yeah. I wanted to be there and be in the moment
and see
what that
time.
Was like.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah,
I know all his bits, but I yeah. didn't want to know. I didn't know what he was doing when he started the Martin Luther King joke. I knew the joke and I was like, I can't believe
he's
this joke got approved.
Yeah, yeah,
that's
right,
what I
right.
kept thinking.
Right,
and I
right.
was like, oh my God, I wonder if he's editing it. And when he drops the punchline, I hear the room go, oh, ah!
Yeah, yeah,
it
yeah.
was like a ooh. And then the biggest laugh I've ever heard in there. And I
yeah,
was like, oh my God.
It's definitely a very interesting crowd. And I mean, you know, I don't know if it has to do with the fact that it's on TBS that they can approve that stuff now.
Right.
But it's like the bear joke that I did in the set was like the best, definitely the best joke of the set.
Oh,
like,
yeah, absolutely.
It had the best reaction.
Yeah.
And it's like, it was like redemption because it was like, I had the joke since the beginning of the streak.
Yeah.
I just wanted to get it on TV. That's all I wanted to do. Did it in my audition set at America's Got Talent.
Yep.
And, I thought they were going to air it. Like it went so it, like the crowd turned on me. This was the interesting thing.
Yeah,
is that I went up. I did on my audition in St. Louis.
Right.
Like I auditioned here in L.A. initially, but they called me out
for America's Got Talent.
For America's Got Talent.
Right.
I did like the.
But
I
then
did,
you shot it in Vegas.
So the you do your like your audition for the producers in a certain city. I did in L.A.
That and shit's kind of fake, right? Because they want to make it look like you're from some other city.
Yeah, so that's the thing. Like they only want to do these initial showcases where they have the whole crowd. They have Howard, the judges. You know
right,
what I mean?
Right.
They only want to do so many of them. And they didn't have room in their L.A. one or S.F. one, so they said, we're going to put you in St. Louis. I was on the standby list.
Wow.
So they initially called me, told me I was on standby. I'm like, oh, I'm not going to get it. So yeah. But then they called me up one night, and this was like a night after I just like bombed my Montreal showcase. I was like, oh. And then I get a call from America's Got Talent. They're like, you're in. And I was like, holy shit.
Yeah, that's how comedy is.
Crazy,
isn't
right?
It weird?
That's just how it works. It always,
dude,
like,
I
one
mean,
door
I
closes.
For, I opened for Artie Lang on a Friday night, sold out Nokia.
Yeah.
And 2 days later, four people at a bar in Huntington
it's
Beach.
So, oh, it's just like
watching an Angels game.
It's a roller coaster.
It is.
Like
you
got
to be
coaster.
Able to put up with it, man.
It's so crazy. And so as soon as I got that, I started hustling because it was a 90 second spot, a
wow.
minute and a half, not even 3 minutes.
Wow.
So it's like this couldn't even count as my set. You know what
yeah.
I mean? I had to do.
Oh just, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So when
but
I did
TV, this, you get a pass.
Yeah, for TV, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I did. I was working on my 90 seconds everywhere in LA. And then I flew out to St. Louis, and I was scared because I'd never been to St. Louis before.
It's totally boring.
It's totally different. It's the middle of the country. Like, I had done New York. I had done all the West Coast. I've even done some in the South. My family lives in Dallas.
Right.
I know it's very different there.
And what people don't know, because we haven't talked about your comedy yet, is it's you're Middle Eastern, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's not your typical, you know, I'm Middle Eastern, so I got this, you know, when you're Middle Eastern, boop, 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 you know, at the airport, you do incredibly smart, funny comedy.
Thank you.
It's edgy and it's kind of alt comedy, but it's really smart. So what I'm saying is, I know you're scared because you're in St. Louis. It could go over there.
And it's like, this is going to be my first TV debut, and I don't even know.
Yeah,
you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's like, I don't. So I was up online. I was researching St. Louis. I was like, what is their intelligence level?
Yeah.
So I looked up nations ranked cities by intelligence, and San Francisco is like number two or something like that.
Yeah,
it's like way up there.
Yeah.
And like New York City, number three. I forget who was number one. But like New York, San Francisco. Very smart cities. And then St. Louis was in the middle. It was like 25th, tied with L.A.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's like, oh, L.A. and St. Louis. Because I get it. L.A. is a mixed bag.
It is.
L.A. is where like, people from everywhere come, the smart and the dumb. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So then it was ranked halfway. And I'm like, oh, St. Louis is just like that. So I'm like, hey, look, if it gets by in large numbers in L.A., it will get by in St. Louis.
Right. If it works at Bray Improv, probably.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
That's a good barometer, you know,
yeah.
Bray Improv.
Yeah.
Really, you could go out there.
Bray Improv, they got a lot of heart. I'll tell you, they got a lot of heart.
Yeah, yeah.
but yeah, so I was like, and there was another joke I did, and it was a Jewish joke, but it's like a very friendly joke, but it's like an easy. It's just easy, but it's like, it's just I say, you know, I asked my Jewish friend, I said, hey, what do you like most about being Jewish? He's like, oh, I never thought about that before. I was like, just give me something off the top of your head. So he gave me his yarmulke. He's like, oh, a little simple play on words. And I'm like, oh, just kidding. He sold it to me. You know, like funny, funny, really easy, but it's always just like a nice, like fun, you know,
it's
for
totally
the family. It's clean.
Fucking, yeah.
It's clean. You know what I mean?
So, it's comedy magic.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm like, I'm gonna do this, but I wanted to do it because I knew Howard Stern and Howie Mandel, Sharon Osbourne. It's like risky, but it's like they're Jewish
and
they would love
like
it.
That, you put in the time.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
And they think, well, this is cool. This is a fun joke.
Yeah, exactly. So right. I was like, all right, I'm going to do that. So I opened with like, I just said, you know, I'm Lebanese. You know what they say about Lebanese guys? Nothing. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah, I love that joke. Yeah.
Then I do the Jewish joke and then I do the bear joke. So
that's the 90 seconds.
Yeah.
They got a big clock there. Can you see a clock?
You can't see the clock, but you're just supposed to kind of know. Like, so this is the crazy thing. They like say, you're doing 90 seconds, you're doing 90 seconds. Once you get up there, nobody's really timing you.
That's weird.
You could probably go 2 minutes, but like they're going to edit shit out. Like,
oh, yeah. And then they might fuck your joke up.
Yeah, exactly. But this is the thing. I went over 90 seconds. This is what happened. I went out there. I did those first two jokes. And they both got applauses, but I went up like last. I was in the showcase of 20 people.
Yeah.
It had been 4 hours.
Wow.
This is a crowd of 3,000.
Whoa.
At this theater. I think it's the Fox Theater. It was like Golden Palace
yeah,
in St. Louis.
Right?
It was huge. Have you been there?
Well, I just know any Fox Theater.
It was a Fox
They're
Theater.
All
it was gold.
Great.
It was a palace, man. 3,000 people. And I had some cousins there. My cousin lived in St. Louis. My cousin from Kansas came out. And so, like, I come on stage. They're cheering for me, but, like, I'm up last. This is a crowd of like 3,000 people. And you know how big crowds. crowds especially get tired.
Oh, God.
You know what I mean? They get
tired. 4 hours.
Yeah. It's like something about the tiredness plus the time makes the crowd get even like mob action.
And
you know
like,
what I mean?
How long have we been in here? And they've seen like some circus acts.
And the last five acts all got X'd because like they're getting tired. They're like, boo. And then like, so I'm walking like three bands in a row are getting X'd. I'm going out there. I got the dry mouth. You know what I mean? They push me out there, and I'm like, you know, I do my first joke. It kind of gets a slow applause, finally. Then I do the second joke, and then everybody kind of relaxes. The yarmulke joke kind of opens everyone up. Then I start the bear joke, and I'm like, okay, you know, my friend's an environmentalist. He's always talking about the polar bears have feelings, too. The polar bears are just like people. When the ice caps melt, where are the polar bears going to go? I'm like, come on, if bears are just like people, I'm sure the polar bears will be okay, right? And I'd make an awkward pause. I always make an awkward pause at that point. Now, this is the thing. They tell the crowds at America's Got Talent to boo if you don't like something.
Really?
And cheer if you don't like it. Yes, they tell them that before the show.
They tell them to boo.
To make the thing more dramatic. That's why whenever you see all those standing O's, those are fake. And we never see people booing people. That's fake because people are just, they're acting more off of impulse.
Yeah,
and they're trying to add drama to the show.
Yeah.
It's not reality at all. I mean, but so they do that. But I get why it makes the show more interesting. I'm not stealing from their art. Yeah. So, okay, cool. Keep doing that. That's fine. But, you know, some guy in the crowd thinks that the joke is over when I do that awkward pause. Because you could think, I'm just like, well, maybe that's just a really stupid joke.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, come on, if bears are just like people, I'm sure the polar bears will be okay, right, guys?
And then you just end.
Silence. And one guy's.
I'm Samuel Bay.
No, I'm Samuel Bay. Thank you. Good night. And one guy
throw
was.
Throw the mic.
Yeah, and that's what one guy was seeing in his head. You know what I mean? Yeah. So he was like, boo! And then all of a sudden, like, all these people around him, like, you know what? He's right. Boo! And then soon the whole lower level, I'm talking to over 1,000 people booing me. You know what I mean? And then more people booing me in the balcony. Now I have, like, probably what's half of the room booing me because the crowd told them that the joke was over.
Right.
And then it's done. And then I was like, okay, either you can run off stage and fucking have this be the biggest failure of your life.
Yeah.
Or you can balls up on these people.
Yeah.
And it's like, and this is the thing, because I knew that of the jokes that I was telling, this racial one would be the most like polarizing. You know what I mean?
Totally.
And so I was like, all right. So I was like, okay. I was like, no, guys, come on. And then everybody's like, what? I'm like, because they'll just, the polar bears, they'll just take land from the grizzly bears. And everybody's like, what? What is he talking about?
Yeah.
You know, to take land from the, have the black bears do all the work. And that's when people are like, oh, and then like some like black lady's like, oh, no, he didn't. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. St. Louis.
And then some people like, even though they fucking hate me, they want to laugh at that. They're like, oh, shit, that's funny.
Yeah.
And then some people start clapping that and they think that's the end of the joke. I'm like, no, and have the panda bears build them railroads. And then everybody's like, oh,
yeah.
And they all start clapping and then people get, and then now it's like, which is, again, it's fake. Now that they like it, they're acting even more like they like it.
Yeah,
so it's like I got an ultimate boo, and
that's
then I got a standing O.
That's
they all
great.
Got up and they gave me a standing O. It was like, you know, do you remember Susan Boyle?
Yeah.
Right? The lady in Britain.
Same,
and,
same,
it was like that was my Susan Boyle story.
Wow.
You know what I mean?
So great, right? How great is that? Because it's just boo. Yeah. Oh, no, we like him.
Yeah, and they turned
and
it around.
And we're talking about in a 10-second period.
Yeah, and there is something to say about when a crowd underestimates a comedian and thinks that a joke is not going to work out, and then it does. The comedian was like, oh, fooled you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it was one of those moments.
Yeah.
And even though at this point, like, the joke was just like, it was totally butchered. Like, it was way longer than it should have been and all that stuff. But it was like the situation, I was like, when that comes on TV, that's going to be my moment. That's going to be my big YouTube clip. You know what I mean?
You're all happy because it goes, comic gets booed, then standing. No, that's the title.
I don't need to look flawless. I just need to fucking get a video out there that shows, like, makes me look kind of like a hero. You know
Like the famous Bill Burr video.
Exactly.
Everybody's favorite
video. Like, people get on your site more because people are booing you and you flip things around. So I'm like, this is it. This is it. And then they ended up pulling it from the program. And I basically, what I heard from my the producer that I was working with is that the material, the producers, even though they gave me permission to do the material, executive producers just didn't make the cut.
Right.
So and I knew it was because of the racial stuff.
Yeah.
So
I mean, they're just dealing with advertisers.
Yeah, totally. And I get it because like in the Vegas, I did like a Mexican a joke about Mexicans are like going to be the most future population in America.
Yeah.
And like you think about it, like there's Latino like viewer base is huge for NBC, and it's just like any joke that could be taken negatively.
Oh, that's out
it's
of
like that's funny. And I did a joke of like that was like about the environment, and they're like they're trying to sell cars and shit.
And I was
like, and then I didn't think about this until later. I was like, what was I doing? Because they approved the material.
Yeah,
but you don't think about what the execs are actually gonna.
The upstairs is like, hey, what?
Yeah.
You went to college, right?
Yeah.
Where'd you go to college? Stanford?
I went to UC Berkeley.
UC Berkeley.
Stanford.
And you graduated?
I graduated, yeah.
What'd you go to school for?
I double majored in business and applied math.
And you just threw it away, right?
Threw it away. This is the thing. Most comedians, and this is not me trying to brag. I really don't. Me being smart has never been. I would rather let someone else have the smarts and have all the burdens that come with it and just enjoy life more. Do you know what I mean? The smarter you are, the more everybody's smart in their own way. You know what I mean? You overthink shit. Anyways, I got good grades my whole life. I was nearly 4.0 graduate.
Where'd you grow up? What city?
I grew up in Fremont, California.
Fremont?
Yeah.
I did a lot of crank out in Fremont.
You know, I did too. For 1 year, dabbling in crank. Yeah,
isn't that?
What if it was the same year?
Yeah.
No. 1998.
No, I'm way too old for you.
Okay. Not 1998.
80s.
Okay. All right. Good.
Here's an amazing thing about crank, which we call it. We share the term crank.
Yeah, crank.
Because we're from fucking the Bay Area and Fremont.
Yeah, I didn't know crank is not a very popular drug outside of certain areas.
Right. It's weird, right? It's like such a Fremont biker crank thing. Isn't it like weird? Like I just spent a lot of time in Fremont at Niles Station, which is down there in the Alvarado Niles, which was where Charlie Chaplin thought he was going to build his new Hollywood.
Fremont was the original Hollywood.
It was weird. It was weird, right?
Yeah.
Like Charlie Chaplin's like, I'll build my own studio, make my own movies out here.
And they put Niles on the hill, like just like Hollywood.
I know. It's so weird. But the weird part about it is that little nook is full of meth, which I don't get at all. And I would go out there and just stay up for 2-3 days and play rock and drink booze and no one seemed to work.
I was never more inspired than when I did crank one night.
Yeah.
I was just so inspired. I don't think I actually did anything with the inspiration the next day. You know, I think I just kind of came down and whatever went on with my life. But I was so inspired that night.
I know. Like, you always, let's go to Great America tomorrow.
Yeah, let's do something fun. Huh?
Yeah,
let's write a
great
song.
America. Yeah, writing songs. Some of the worst songs ever. You think they're great. You're just mining over a little tinkering.
That's funny because, you know, artists will use drugs like hallucinogens and marijuana to enhance their creativity. Like, who uses crank? What are they? You mean it's like, dunk, 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 dunk.
Everything with like crank mechanical. You throw away.
Yeah.
You're writing a song, the other guy's in the room just a solder. A guitar together and apart. What got you into it out there?
Crank?
Yeah.
Well, me and my buddies, like when we were 13, 14, we started dabbling with stuff early. Started with marijuana. Started marijuana, alcohol, and then like we could find a harder drug, we would try it.
Yeah.
And one night, me and my buddy, we were 14 years old, and we scored some crank from this guy. And we're like, how do you do it? He's like, just break it up and roll up a dollar bill and snort it.
Yep.
And we did that and we were up all night. It was one of those things where he told his parents he was spending it at my house. I told mine that I was spending that at his house.
Yep.
And we just roamed free.
Wow.
And we did crank. It was just such a breathtaking night.
It's so strong, right? It's so strong. Like you do a bump and then you're just immediately up.
Yeah.
How could something that small keep you up so long?
You know, I'm so glad that I did crank before I ever tried coke, because coke is so much more of a pure euphoria and up. Like, that crank is dirty. There's something very dirty about it.
Yeah.
But it has like stamina. Like it's like the coke is like brings you up and then brings you down. Yeah. Whereas like crank is like it's driving force. You know what I mean?
There's something about crank to me that the logo should be a 9-volt battery. What's the one with the cat on it? That 9-volt battery with the cat, Ray-Van or whatever.
Oh yeah,
Ever Ready.
Yeah.
To me, that should be their logo, because crank. The whole time you're on it, you're just like, man, there's nothing that can stop you.
No, not at all. Oh my god. I mean, I only ended up doing it maybe like 10 times.
Right.
But I mean, thank god. I mean, cuz some people never came back from that, the land of
crank. Oh god, right? They just fucking I compare it to this one guy one time, this doctor told me that people's brains are like a rubber band, and some people can keep getting high, and then the rubber band stretches back.
Yeah.
And some people, you stretch the rubber band too many times, and then it just snaps, and they stay at this weird snap thing.
Wow, I've never heard that. That's a good analogy.
Yeah, and it's totally true. Like, you'll see a guy, and you'll be like, what happened to that guy?
The rubber band.
Yeah, rubber band man.
You know, I don't know if I ever talked much about these, but music was always my first thing. Like, I always, I know that you were, you were a rock star, and that was my original
dream.
I wasn't
a rock star, but I played rock, yeah.
Well, hey, man, you know, it's just like...
So you wanted to play music first?
Yeah, that was my thing when I was 11, and that was kind of why I ended up like going through that drug phase, because I got disillusioned, because when I was 11, 12, I really got into guitar, and I was like, that's what I want to do for the rest of my life.
Who were
like
you into?
Well, it was the, you know, I was into like the 90s grunge music, but like my idol was Hendrix.
Oh, God, yeah. But you're into like, who's your favorite out of the grunge? I always ask people this. It's almost a great
four.
Yeah, the big four. You know, like, you got Nirvana, Soundgarden, yeah. Alice in Chains, and Pearl Jam.
Well, let me be clear. I like them all.
Yep.
Pearl Jam was the first one I got into. Nirvana was really easy to get into.
Yeah.
Alice in Chains have a very special spot for them, but I think Soundgarden was the one I liked the most.
Which record?
Bad Motorfinger.
Yeah, that's a great record.
That's
right?
Jesus Christ Pose. Yeah, the thing I like about Soundgarden is like they started off like their sound was always cool and unique. They were on Sub Pop Records, and then they were kind of goofy. Like, I don't know if you have any of their older albums.
Yeah,
but
I got
Louder,
those, Flower and
Louder Than Love, and they're like the
Loud
like,
Love is my favorite.
Yeah, it's great music. They're kind of like they're a little goofy, and then they got like more serious.
Yeah,
when you know like Chris Black Cornell Hole Sun after and all that. Andy, what's his name? The guy died. Andrew Wood. They died. Mother Love. You could tell Chris Cornell got way more serious.
Right.
So for Bad Motorfinger, like came hard in that one, man.
Yeah.
It was just like, and then. And that was when he had so much power in his voice. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah,
like he was blowing out speakers with that voice.
People always think he's a great singer now, and it's nowhere near what it was, man.
He sacrificed. He put out so much then. I mean, I don't know. You know, it's hard. You got to strain your voice, but it's like at some point you just got to accept. You got to start singing lower.
That Louder Than Love record is fucking. It was the Sabbath Part Two.
Yeah,
man. Yeah, you know, like I got an idea.
Oh, the
of
gun. That's the song is amazing. Yeah,
with a gun.
That's the. I guess that is a very underrated album.
And they
like Get on the Snake and
Get on the Snake. Full on Kevin's Mom.
Full on Kevin's Mom. The one about the environment too is really good.
That's my favorite. Hands all over.
Hands all over. And the Ugly Truth. The Ugly Truth is a great song.
That intro is
such a cool intro.
That record. You know what's funny was at the time the booking agent for Soundgarden was Triad, which later became William Morris.
Oh,
guy's name there was Tom LaPenna. He was my booking agent.
No shit.
And he said, "Hey, man, you got to check this band out we just signed."
Yeah.
Called Soundgarden.
Yeah.
I remember I was like, "What a great name!"
Was it the late '80s or early '90s?
Right before Loud Love.
Okay, so like 1989 or something.
Yeah, so I had that Ultra Mega OK.
Yeah.
So he sent that to me. I go, "Yeah, this is pretty good." And then he sent me Loud Love, and I was like, "Louder Than Love." And I was like, "Oh my God!" And I remember this key day I got it. I put it on, and I went into the kitchen to get beers. I had it on like 10. The World Series was on, Giants A's.
Yeah.
And I remember my buddy was in the living room. I was getting beers, and it was like, you know, that first song came on. You know, I think it's Hands All Over or whatever.
Yeah.
And it was cranking, and then it went off, and I went, "Hey, man, what the fuck?"
Turn that shit back.
Right when I said, "Hey, man," the house was buckling. You know, the 89 quake.
Or an earthquake. Wow, you're listening to that song during
earthquake. And I was like,
the land, and the fucking land fights back.
Isn't that weird?
That's crazy.
And the fucking, my apartment just cracks in half. I'm like, what the fuck? But I remember seeing Soundgarden many times, but one of the dates I remember, Tom said, "You got to go to Santa Barbara, they're playing a frat house." Because they're still pretty new, know what I mean?
Yeah.
They did a tour with Prong at the Stone, and I saw him, and I was like, this band is God. Cornell didn't play guitar back then. He's just a front man.
He's front man. He just fall over
he
the place.
He was so cool.
He was wild,
And we went to this frat house, and it was giant. It was just like that Animal House style house. Same thing. They set up in the living room, which is a huge Craftsman, like two-story, and they played to about 200, people at a 20-keg frat party.
Wow.
And their plan was to hit colleges and spread the word. And it was unbelievable. I never forgot it. Like 2 feet away from Soundgarden.
That's
and they're
crazy.
Playing
oh,
like
you're lucky,
fucking
man.
Full-on Kevin's Mom.
Power Trip. That was another good song, too.
Yeah.
Those that album and then Bad Motorfinger, I think, were just like next level. Some next level shit.
Oh, Bad Motorfinger, man. That Jesus Christ Pose song,
Jesus
man.
Christ Pose.
What a great band. But now when I look at it, at the end of the day, it's Alice in Chains for me.
Yeah, I think Alice in Chains, like I said, have a soft spot for them.
Yeah.
I think it's because, it has to do with, I just always love their music. Jerry Cantrell is a genius.
Yep.
Master musician. And then, the Layne Staley story is, it's sad. I mean, Kurt Cobain died, too.
Yeah.
But I just feel like I have a softer spot for Layne Staley.
Yeah, because that's a true fucking
drug
tragedy.
Story. Yeah. Kurt Cobain was fucked up. He had issues, whatever.
Yeah, yeah. That's all mental.
And
with,
fame, the fame was so intense for him. I mean, I'm sure, Layne, they were famous, but never as famous as Nirvana.
Right. Layne, it was just, to me, Layne was so badass, too. Because he didn't move around or anything. He stood in one spot. He's like Norm MacDonald. I love Norm MacDonald when he does comedy. He doesn't move or anything.
Yeah.
But what he's saying is killing me.
And he was also one of those guys who, his voice in the beginning was killer.
Oh, my God.
But it wasn't even that his voice fell off. It was just his whole consciousness kind of fell off.
Yeah.
So he couldn't sing as strong. But you listen to Facelift, he's out there.
Love, hate, love.
If you
haven't seen this, I'm talking to the people that are listening. Type in Love, Hate, Love live at the Moore Theater.
I should watch that.
It's the first record, and they did a 8-song video at the Moore Theater. It's black and white. It's one of the most powerful vocal performances.
I should watch that.
It'll blow your mind. Now, you play guitar?
Yeah, so I play guitar. I started when I was 11. This was right when I was getting into that kind of music. And my dad had played guitar, too. He used to be in a band when he was in high school and early college.
Where'd your dad grow up?
He grew up in Beirut, Lebanon.
Wow.
Yeah, he had a band out there, and then he had a band in Texas. He moved to Texas. He went to UT, which is where I met my mom. And then he had a band for a while. He had, long hair, and his little brother was the bassist.
He probably looked like Kim Thayil.
He did. Yeah. You know, it's funny. My sister used to work in the management. She was Jerry Cantrell's assistant manager for a while. She was assistant to his manager, Bill Siddons.
Bill
Siddons managed the Doors. She was Bill Siddons' assistant, so she used to do runs for Jerry, and so we met Jerry that way. But she also she met Kim Thayil a bunch of times.
Yeah,
and it's funny. It's funny how because as a kid I was so into them, and then I was now going to functions with her and meeting these people, and it was almost starstruck.
This was years
after. I was so into them when I was 11, 12.
Yeah.
And this is my early 20s, after things have changed. I'd been into rap and electronic music, and it's all this shit has changed,
but you're still going,
but
like,
I'm
wow,
still
that,
like holy
that
shit
was the gateway guy.
Yeah, like Jerry Cantrell, he came to the office and he gave me a wink. He's like, hey there, buddy. And I was like, holy shit, dude.
Yeah. Hey there, little buddy.
Yeah.
Want to smoke some crack?
Yeah. Because when I was 12, 11, I was, buying, Alice in Chains tab books. And you know what I mean? I was learning all the shit. But at the same time, I was taking lessons and learning classical. So I could read music and then play tab. I was just all in.
Wow, that's cool.
11, 12.
What kind of guitar do you have?
I started off with a nylon string for classical, and then I got a Fender acoustic with steel string.
Yep.
And then my dad handed me down his 1964 Fender Stratocaster.
Whoa, original?
Yes.
Wow, you still got it?
I still got it. This thing. I mean, I don't know if market value goes down. If it's possible to go down, they never go down.
No.
This is. I mean, I put it out there a few years ago and let people know. The value is close to $50,000.
Yeah. What color?
This is a few years ago. It was Sunburst, and he painted it white.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I know.
Wiped out the back.
So, but it was just it's one of those things. I'm just keeping this. It's legendary. But, I mean, I had to get a couple repairs to it done. The calibration was kind of off.
Yeah.
But it was,
of course, the next move. And,
yeah.
You know.
But I always loved Gibsons. Yeah. I never had one myself. My dad has one.
I'm obsessed with guitars.
Oh, me too.
So I love 59, yeah. 60, 61, 62 Fenders. That's the,
really, yeah.
Those are the slab board rosewood guitars.
Yes, yes.
And then in 63, they go to curved rosewood, which right. is different. I also love the clay dots, actual clay dots on those fretboards.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
clay
yeah, yeah. That's
clay.
Oh, really?
Fades, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know.
And some can shrink.
Do you think I have that on the 64?
Clay dots. It has clay dots up until they go to jewel dots, I think, and when
yeah, think
CBS takes it over. But I love the 59 Les Paul more than anything, the Sunburst, the Jimmy Page.
Yeah.
All the Kings played it. You know, the dude from Free, Kesoff.
Yeah.
Jimmy Page, you know, the 59 Paul Sunburst. Like
first concert I ever went to was Jimmy Page and Robert Plant reunion.
Oh,
no,
yeah.
No Quarter.
Oh, that's so dope. Did you see it at the Shoreline?
Was it at the Shoreline?
I saw it at the Shoreline.
It was in the South Bay.
Right.
I don't think it was at the Shoreline. It was another one of these South Bay venues.
Right.
Was it like possibly San Jose Spartan Stadium?
Oh, yeah.
Or somewhere like that.
I just did San Jose Improv.
Yeah.
And I was telling the crowd, like, man, I have such roots in here. KSJO.
Yeah.
KOME. Spartan Stadium. Saw Pearl Jam there on the Versus Tour.
Yeah, I saw Pearl Jam there, too, when they did the Money Back. Did you ever go to the
one? Oh, yeah, remember that?
When Eddie Vedder got sick.
Yeah.
And then he couldn't perform. Were you there, Golden Gate Park?
Yeah, yeah, remember that? And then
Neil Young came out and was just shredding.
Yeah, yeah. That was amazing.
So we
right?
all got refund tickets to Spartan Stadium. A year later. And he, like, apologized, and he did an extra long set.
Dude, I saw Maiden there at Spartan.
Yeah.
And I saw ZZ Top at Spartan. And then San Jose Civic, I saw Dio Queensryche. So, you know, and then later they built that Sharks Arena, and I had to fucking go there all the time because I used to go to the concerts at the Cow Palace.
It was a nice place.
But yeah.
I liked all the grunge bands, and I played all, I learned all their songs.
Yeah.
And like,
now, were you singing too?
So I would write tunes, and then I would like kind of think of melodies, but I never wanted to sing. I was always afraid of my singing voice.
Oh, yeah.
Until after I graduated. When I graduated college, I kind of had this like, what the fuck am I doing with my life moment. I just started taking a bunch of extracurricular stuff at like a community college. This was about when I started stand-up.
Yeah.
And one thing I took was a singing class at a community college, which singing class, like you go to certain places, you pay for singing, you're paying a lot of money. But if you go to a community college and you take music lessons, you're paying a I was paying $20 a semester for like full on singing. I would go once a week and meet with the singing teacher, and we would like do exercises and shit.
Yeah, I went to singing. I went to a singing teacher once a week.
Yeah,
it was like $50.
You had to pay per session
for an hour. Yeah,
sure. Yeah,
but man, I tell you what, you learn so much about. You don't learn how to sing per se. You learn how to use your voice and become longevity.
Absolutely.
And man, has it's helped me so much in my life with anything like comedy. You know,
it's really about aligning your breathing and all these things that
projection.
Help you in so many other ways in all sorts. That's why I'm sure you ascended really fast in comedy because you have that stage experience and you have the management of your own voice.
Yeah,
you know
exactly.
What I mean?
Now. You know, me, you, and Burr got a jam then because Burr plays drums.
Oh, does he?
Yeah, and he wants to jam. And then
I love playing. I love playing bass. I was never a formally bassist trained, but I love it. I love slapping bass.
Oh man, I just saw the James Brown movie.
Yeah,
and man, I remember when I was growing up, I wanted to play bass because of that band Lakeside.
Yeah,
it's all the way live.
Yeah,
it's all the way live.
Yeah.
You know, and. And Bootsy Collins and Funkadelic and all that did you get into that stuff, man?
No, I didn't, but I know vaguely what you're talking about.
Right, yeah, that shit is incredible. You got to see the James Brown movie.
I should look it up. Yeah, I mean, I love all things bass. I mean, that's just like, I love playing it. I mean, I do, you know, some keys every now and then, but
yeah.
I'm more of a guitar guy. Not like I'm more lead like soloing, but I'm more into melody than I am to rhythm.
Yeah, yeah. I play rhythm, and I'm terrible at soloing.
Really?
I mean, I can do it just solo around like in the key, you know. But rhythm, I can play rhythm and sing at the same time.
I like doing lead guitar, like melody, and then I also like doing like backup accentuation vocals. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't like being the main singer. I like just helping out. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you'd be good in James Brown's band because they're like, oh, out of bed. Get on it. Get on it. You know. Dun, 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 dun.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
shake your money maker. I love that. What got you into comedy? Who was it?
Because
you grew up in the Bay Area. That's kind of a different style comedy up there, San Fran.
Yeah, it was like a long list of things. So basically, you know, long story short about the guitar thing, I always wanted to do that.
Yeah.
As a kid, and my main idol for that was Hendrix. So it was like when I was 12, I was like, I'm doing music for sure. Like as a kid, I was a goofy kid, so people would head every now and then and say, hey, you should be a comedian, like jokingly as kids.
Yeah.
But like it didn't really mean anything to me.
Yep.
As soon as I discovered music, I was like, that's what I want to do. But then I got kind of disillusioned because I think it just kind of growing up, becoming an adolescent.
Yeah.
There's something about like hormones and everything. Like I became less interested in wanting to be, you know, a musician and more interested in just like living life.
Wow.
And
that's crazy.
And like my friends were like doing drugs. So I started like doing drugs and I admit I really liked it. I really liked pot and I was like,
yeah,
this is fun.
Smoke pot now?
Hell yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, hell yeah. Hell yeah. it's like part of childhood for me at this point.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But yeah, so it was like all these things were disillusioned. Another thing is I looked up to Hendrix. Hendrix was my main idol. Like,
yeah.
My dad like was a big Hendrix fan, so I was exposed to all his stuff early on.
Love Hendrix.
And Hendrix was like, I mean, I loved the grunge stuff. That felt more contemporary to me, but like Hendrix to me was like the master of guitar.
Yeah, some more Seattle rock.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean?
And it went along with that same feel. It went very in sync with musically what I liked. And somebody told me that he started guitar when he was 4.
Wow.
And I was like, holy shit.
I had his brother on the show.
4 years old. Really?
Boy, was he cuckoo.
Really?
Yeah. He is a great guy, but man, he told some wild stories.
Really?
Yeah, he was a pimp in the 70s.
Wow. Older brother, younger brother?
Leon Hendrix is his name, and
yeah, younger
I think
brother?
He's the younger brother.
Yeah.
He has some of Jimmy's guitars.
Yeah.
But he says, and of course he's got, you know, the story. He says that Jimmy was an okay guitar player or whatever. And then when he was 13, a spaceship came down.
Wow.
In Seattle. They were out smoking some reefer in the field.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said that he played like a king a week later.
Wow.
So, you know,
yeah,
I love Leon. If he makes stories
that's
up,
funny.
It's cool.
I mean, that's, yeah, he's got a vivid imagination.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, Jimmy's an interesting thing, you know, because you got to think he goes to England. He's just a backup guy. You know?
And then suddenly he stands out, and his style was so authentic. It was so nothing like anyone before.
Yeah.
So when somebody told me that he started playing at 4, I was like, oh, that makes sense because he's so natural at it.
Right.
And that's when I started understanding, like, you know, the 10,000 hours thing, like in theory, like how that works. You start young, you get really good. And I was like 13 years old at this point, and I started when I was 11. And I was like, fuck, like, you know, Hendrix started 7 years before. I'm never going to be as good as Hendrix.
Yeah.
You know,
because you can't grasp natural talent.
Yeah, mathematically, like, I was just thinking, like, if you're, as a kid, he's learning, like, the muscle movement as a 4-year-old. Dude, when his hands are going to grow up to be made for a guitar.
Yeah.
That's why he's shredding so much. So I'm like, fuck. So I'm like, that kind of disillusions me. And there's the drugs thing and my hormones. So I'm like, I want chicks now.
Yep.
You know what I mean? I don't give a shit about guitar anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was in a band.
But guitars are gateway to vagina.
They are, but the culture at my school had changed. It became hip hop culture where it was like now guitar was not cool.
I get you.
Fuck.
Now, yeah.
It's like, I'm not going to go into rapping.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
Samuel Ben Robin. Yo, straight out of Fremont.
Yeah, exactly.
Crazy motherfucker on meth.
Exactly. So it was like, it's disillusioning because that had been my dream, and that kind of like fell apart in my head. So meanwhile, I was just like, I was taking guitar lessons, and I was in a band with my sister.
Wow.
My sister's 3 years older than me, so I was in junior high.
What were you guys called?
13, 14. What's that?
What were we called?
We had two names. Our first one was Window Pane.
Yeah,
with like pain, like yeah. And then the other one was Truly.
Truly.
Truly. But it was a band of all girls and me. So it was 3 girls and me. And I was 13, 14, and they were like, you know, juniors in high school.
Yeah.
So they were all, so teenage girls, my sister, lead singer. And then we had this girl, my sister's best friend, Swetha, who's a drummer. She's Indian. And then we had this cheerleader, She would like wear a cheerleader uniform and do
yeah.
She's like
opposite of Angus Young.
Yeah, exactly.
So Angus wore a school suit. I'll be a cheerleader.
Yeah, yeah, right. And then me, I was like a 13-year-old like child with like a mushroom haircut and just shredding. I was fucking giving it my all. So we were a little something something to see. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And this was like we played county fairs in Alameda County Fair.
Oh yeah.
We played like some talent shows. We did the talent show at my high school and like we won. And like we were, everything was going well. But then, like the thing, they graduated high school.
Yeah,
my band left. You know what I mean? I had no one to jam with. Nobody was playing guitar at my school. They were all into rap. And like now, I was smoking.
Where'd you go to school? Fremont.
In Fremont, but like the culture at this time was like it was just like everybody was like trying to be a gangster.
Yeah,
like just it was stupid. Even in the nice, even in the nice neighborhood.
NWA.
Or everybody was like a square, and they weren't like into rock and roll.
Yeah.
So it was like one of those things. It was like I like the only people who were kind of like that were like the skaters, but they just kind of smoked pot and like listened to music. Nobody played it.
Yeah, they didn't play it.
So I was just like,
it was
fuck.
Soundtrack to their crashes.
Yeah, exactly. So I gave up. I just gave up guitar. I was like, it's you know I and the other thing was I was going to lessons with this guy who was really cool, but he. He had this like weird skiing accident, so he hurt his back. So he had to start taking medication. So we'd go to lessons. I'd be stoned. He'd be stoned.
Yeah.
And we just wouldn't be getting anything done.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I told my parents were paying for it. They're paying like $50 a session. So I was like, don't pay for this anymore. Like, you know. So I got disillusioned. I quit. When I was 15 years old, I quit. I just gave up. I gave up a dream.
Wow.
So I know what it's like to give up a dream.
Yeah, yeah, right.
So
yeah.
So basically a few years later I graduate high school. I end up getting good grades. You know, I kind of curb the drugs. I still smoke pot, drink, but I'm able to get good grades. And then my first semester at Cal Berkeley, I take this public speaking course and the professor sees me do a couple funny speeches and he pulls me aside. He's like, hey, I think you should try stand-up comedy.
Really?
This is when I'm 18 years old.
Well, that's fucking cool. A professor did that.
Yeah, he was like, okay. I was like, why would you say that? He's like, I think you're natural. And I just took this stand-up class in the city with this guy. His name is Hank Hyena. I was like, ooh, Hank Hyena. What is that all about? You know what I mean?
What a crazy name.
Yeah. So it's my first semester. I'm in college. I'm like, this is a bit, you know, changing point in my life. I'm going to try this out. So I go to this guy's class. His name is Hank Hyena. He's teaching a class in The Mission.
Yeah.
So I get off. I take BART from Berkeley to
Old
SF.
Mission.
The Mission. They, like, people are selling. I get off at 16th.
Crack,
people are selling
right
crack,
there.
Crack, crack. Get to the 20th Street. Go and do this comedy class thing. It was four sessions, and it was very like, you know, put your premises, then your punchlines, and you know, don't scare the audience, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Like I'm with a bunch of adults who are like, you know, just trying to like learn comedy for whatever reason in their life.
Everybody has a reason.
Yeah. So after the first class, like I'm just really weird. I'm like a really weird guy at this time. I just say some weird shit, funny shit, whatever. And then the Hank Hyena comes, he pulls me aside. He's like, hey man, I'm gonna book you on a show right away.
Wow,
it's gonna be in Alameda. It's gonna be in the back of a Vietnamese restaurant.
Yeah.
Now in retrospect, I do think he thought I was funny. But then I realized after that I was able to bring like 30 people to that show that it was a bringer show.
Right.
This didn't register to me like till 10 years later.
Yeah, yeah.
However, I do think that he did think I was funny. Like
right.
I don't think he thought I was just going to fuck up the show because it was a good show that he's putting on, but it's in the back of a Vietnamese restaurant. So I went there and I did this weird character. I wore all black. I put on gloves and I was just like, it was just like, I was going for shock value.
Yeah.
But it was like weird. I was like, I don't want to just go up there and tell jokes. It
like,
was like,
who were you into though? Was it like fucking,
this is the thing.
Know,
I wasn't
Andy
really,
Kaufman or it, like what, why
I mean, I knew Andy Kaufman was, I wasn't trying to mimic anybody,
right.
But there's the thing I will say the only time I watched comedy had been blown away up to then was a Chris Rock special.
Oh yeah.
And this was it wasn't Bring the Pain. It was Bigger and Blacker.
Oh yeah.
Which was like all this topical humor. And I was like, whoa, that was the first time comedy ever blew my mind. So this thing that I was doing was completely different.
Yeah.
It was weird because it was like I like Chris Rock comedy, but I was just like, I don't want to do that. I want to do something weird.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I went up there and it was kind of like a monologue, and it was getting laughs here and there because it was so weird, but there wasn't like set up punchline. People were just getting kind of weirded out.
Yeah.
But my family was there. My sister said she loved it because me and my sister, we like the same kind of, we have the same artistic preferences.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We both like came up with the grunge music and that kind of stuff. We were in the band together for a while. And so she's like, I thought you were great. I love it. Keep doing it.
You got to do a flashback on that.
Yeah.
Belly
yeah.
room one night.
Yeah, yeah. No, I should.
Bring it back, your first set.
I should. Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Right? <That'd be laughs> hilarious.
It is funny because, you know, and then my sister was working in the industry at that time. That's when she was working with Jerry and like she was out making runs and she was basically here in Hollywood. And we would go, we would like babysit like Jerry's house in the Hollywood Hills.
Yeah.
Or house it, whatever.
So you're hooked on the first show?
No. So I think I like, I didn't feel like I bombed, yeah. but I knew it didn't go spectacular. But I didn't. I knew that what I was doing, it wasn't supposed to go crazy.
Right.
But it was like my friends stumbled in late. They were drunk. They got there like the last 2 minutes of my set, and the room was a little warm at that time. So like my friends were like, "Oh, he did well."
Yeah.
You know. And then, but after like I went out and back, and like this group of other people who I didn't know were smoking a cigarette, and then like. And then something like, they're like, "Oh, you coming out here just to hang out by yourself?" I'm like, "No, I'm just going to meet up with my friends," because my friends were out on the street. And they were like, "Yeah, you don't have any friends. Don't lie."
Oh, just mean?
And that's when I was just like, fuck, man, I must have really bombed in there.
Wow.
You know what I mean? I must have really weirded people out. So I continue taking this class. There's like 4 more sessions.
Yep.
But I'm like kind of like disillusioned. I'm kind of like, I don't think I get this. I don't want to do jokes.
Yeah.
Like there's like, this is what the deal with this. And I'm like, I don't want to talk about that shit.
Yeah.
So, and this is when I'm 18, you know? So I'm just like, I'm going to keep doing my character, but I'm going to kind of like polish it a little bit so that it's a little more like, you know, I had this one bit where I was like, I try and con kids out of money for candy.
Yeah.
So it was like an act out of me going to like a playground and be like, "Hey there, little buddy. Hey there, you want some candy?" And just like just being really weird.
Yeah.
And you know, I was like, it wasn't too creepy because I was still a young looking guy, but it was still weird. It was like, what is this guy's deal?
Yeah, yeah. Like, you know? What is this? The other guys are like just doing Seinfeld stuff.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So. But they were getting laughs, granted. Yeah. They were getting laughs. So anyways, we have a graduation show. Club Deluxe.
Oh yeah.
So I just turned 19 now. I'm freshly 19, and our graduation shows at Club Deluxe. We have an 8 o'clock and a 10 o'clock, and they put me up first for both of them because they know that I get people's attention.
Yeah.
My dad would come to these shows, and I was like, how do you think I'm doing? He's like, you definitely have their attention. He's like, I think the only part where they didn't like you is this one part where you were a little cocky.
Yeah,
my dad doesn't like cocky performers.
That's hilarious because you're all cocky now.
Yeah, 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 exactly. exactly. So but you know, he knows I earned it. So he came. My mom was always very supportive.
That's cool because they're Middle Eastern, right?
Yeah, well, because my dad like my dad was, you know,
from an art background.
Yeah, but he ended up being a hippie. Like he grew up in Beirut, but he was, you know, he's bilingual, and then he moved here to the States. You know, and my mom is part Lebanese, but she grew up in Dallas, Texas. So she's
they're like hip Middle Eastern.
Yeah, and it was the 70s when they were meeting and you know, had us in the early, me and my sister in the early 80s. So they were flower, you know, almost, you know, later after flower power, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, but yeah, I get
but like
it.
children of the 70s, 80s. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Spill off, just fun times.
Exactly. They loved Zeppelin and they loved the Beatles. You know,
cool,
the whole deal.
Right?
So that's where I was coming from. But so my parents were very supportive. You know, but it was like, so I did that show and it went a little bit better, but it was still like you're opening at Club Deluxe.
Yeah.
Even if you go now and open, that's a hard room.
It is.
I go back there now and struggle opening up that room.
Yeah, right. And you're doing a character. And
I'm doing a character. My mom and my sister and her friends came to the first show. My dad came to the second show. So it was like I had a couple people there. But it was like, it went okay. But like this other comedian who was on the show, who was like, he was so corny, like doing these corny ass jokes.
He's just killing.
He was an actor trying to be, no, he didn't kill. I mean, he was at least getting laughs on a rhythm.
Right.
But he was like, he was this actor guy trying to do comedy. And he came up to me, and I'm only talking shit about him because he came up to me afterwards and he said this. He's like, "Sammy, I really love what you're doing. Like, it's not ha ha funny, but it's like, I'm so scared right now funny."
Oh no.
So after like that, those two incidents, doing those two shows, I was like, you know what, dude, comedy is not for me. I was like, I'm
really?
Fucking done with it. Yeah, this was not. I did comedy for a month when I was 18 going on 19, and then I was like, you know what, fuck this shit, I'm not doing comedy anymore. So, and it didn't matter because I wasn't even in the scene. I just took a class, did a graduation show. So but then like a couple of people heard that I did comedy. So like one time later in college, this like student group booked me to do a comedy set where I just went and I kind of riffed on the restaurant names in Berkeley.
Right.
But it was more just like a speech.
Crowd work thing, yeah.
And then I ended up doing graduating business where we give a lot of speeches. All my speeches would be funny speeches. So the kids that knew me as like a funny speech guy. But that was my forte. I realized that comedy, stand-up comedy, not my forte. But giving speeches and injecting
like
comedy in them.
Like a spoken word.
Oh my God! So I saw Henry Rollins in 2007. I was blown away.
Well, it's funny that we say that because I just on my episode last week. I don't know when this will be out in the next couple of weeks, but I saw Rollins at UC Berkeley in I think around 92.
Yeah,
he was on 3 hours. It felt like an hour. And that night, I realized two things: this guy loves music like I love it,
mm-hmm.
and he has passion. He can tell stories. I love this.
He's funny too.
Yeah, he's funny. Funny. I love this art form.
Yeah,
is what I was thinking. Yeah, like, man, I'd love to do like one man show where I talk about like just my life from the ground up. Say right, around, right. You know, 12 riding BMX bikes yeah. into rock and roll. Yeah, you yeah. know. That whole thing of when rock and roll first hits you. Mm-hmm. And Rollins really translated the yeah. first time he heard James Brown. An hour of his spoken word was about hearing James Brown at this keg party the first time.
Wow, yeah.
And the way he did it, I went right out and bought a James Brown record, you know. He's wow. like, the way it came out of the yeah, speaker, yeah. you know. It's like, yeah. Papa got a bat, you
yeah,
know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, you know, that spoken word shit is
amazing.
Badass.
I saw him at the Herbs Theater oh, yeah. in SF.
And what was he covering
amazing.
On your run?
Amazing. He was talking about his recent travels.
Right.
I mean, yeah. he's talking about like, his trip to Europe
Africa.
Saw, yeah, yeah, like, yeah. So it was a lot of stories, and it was all, like, really funny, and he had us engaged the whole time.
It's crazy,
This
right?
was the first year that I – so I ended up starting comedy again later, and basically, like – but I knew – in finishing up college, stand-up comedy not for me.
Yep.
But I'm good. I was a good public speaker and giving funny speeches. That's how I got. That's how the guy saw me originally and said you should be a comedian. And I was also good at public speaking when I was in elementary school. So I knew that was one of my strong points and like being silly and funny. But doing stand-up alone just felt completely different. Stand-up is so like relaxed and kind of conversational, where speech is very formal.
Yeah.
You have an agenda, you do it, and then you tell them, you say, I'm putting a joke here.
Yeah.
Whereas a comedian just kind of, it's just like, you know, it's kind of sneaky.
Yeah, yeah,
you know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So I was just like, all right, I was like, I do love giving speeches. So I ended up teaching a class at Cal where it was like I was teaching people public speaking.
Wow.
And so I was like, I was into that. I was like, I don't know what my future is, but it's something there. So I graduated. I also got a degree in math because I was really good at math.
Yeah.
And graduated a good GPA, interviewed with Google, Microsoft. I got an offer from Google and I turned it down because I was like, I realized I had this epiphany when I graduated. I was like, I don't want to be working a desk job. I don't want to be someone's analyst.
Yeah.
I want to do something artistic. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
So I started taking these other classes, soul searching, singing classes, music classes, all this stuff. And I was at this community college in Fremont called Ohlone. You know Ohlone?
I don't.
It's a community college in Fremont. My friend was going there at the same time, and she's like, hey, come take a speech class with me. So I took a speech class with her, and I gave this funny speech, and the professor saw me, and she's like, hey, you should try public speaking for the school team.
Yeah.
So I was like,
they have like a school team.
Yeah. I was 22 years old. I'm at this community college. I just graduated a 4-year,
yeah.
but I looked young, so nobody knew that. They just thought I was an 18-year-old kid. You know, who fucked around in high school.
Yeah, you're going to kill him now,
college.
Right?
Yeah. So they put me on the speech and debate team. I'm killing it. And they put me in this category called after dinner speaking, where you give a funny speech.
Yeah.
And so that's my forte. It's like 10-minute serious speech. My first one was about breathing. It was like why people should breathe better. And I thought of this idea when I was high, but I just kept working on it, injecting jokes in there. It was 2007, like Borat was topical.
Yeah.
I was throwing some Borat ones in there. It was like an easy sell the way I looked.
Yeah.
So it was like I was coming from all angles. And I ended up winning the national tournament with this speech. And this kid in my class at Ohlone saw me, and he's like, you're really funny, man. Do you want to try stand-up comedy? I'm like, I tried that a long time ago, man. It's not for me. He's like, well, look, man, I think you're really funny, and I work at the San Jose Improv. I'm a waiter there. I'm a server.
Oh, there you go.
And they're having a competition.
Oh,
they're having a competition, and like I can get you in, no problem. I'm like, let me think about it. I go to Houston, win the national tournament, come back all cocky. I'm like, put me in that competition.
Yeah.
So he signs me up. I promote to all my friends. I have like a month to work out my 5 minutes. I'm just like going over it in my head every day. I'm changing it around. And then finally I go out there and like I have this. This was back in 2007 when there's this other guy. So I was doing Borat jokes in the beginning of the year. And then I grew up my hair. I had long hair now.
Yeah.
And in 2007, American Idol was big. And there was this kid named Sanjaya on it.
Oh, I remember
him.
This
Indian kid.
Yeah, yeah.
He became this sensation for like 4 weeks.
Yep.
And it was like, it was the perfect timing because I'd walk down the street and people would be like, hey, Sanjaya.
Yeah.
It's like, I look, that the easiest thing to do in comedy is I look like this. It is funny.
I told him.
You know what I mean?
It works
so
forever.
It was, all I had to do was come out and say, but you may remember me as Sanjaya from American Idol. And people go, whoa.
Yeah.
Didn't matter what I did for the next 4 minutes.
Yeah.
I fucking ate shit for the night. I was semi funny for, but this time I was like, I'm going to write jokes, but I'm going to still make them weird. Like when I come from like a weird character. So I did that. And then I did well, and I brought all my friends, so I brought her the competition,
what I
mean?
And you won, right?
I make it to semis, do the same thing, work on my set. This time I start doing open mics and learn by trial and error. My set becomes a little more jokey, but it's doing better now. And then I get to finals, same thing, because I brought friends. Because in this competition, I'm going up against pros. Other people in this competition, Mo Mandel, yeah. Ali Wong, you know what I mean? Yep. Like comics who are out doing it now.
Yeah,
you know
yeah,
what I mean?
Working the punchline
yeah.
and shit.
Yeah, so I made it to the finals. I had 2 months to prepare for the finals. And I was like, look, I have to do my best. I'm gonna go hit a mic every night. So this was when I really became a comic. I was going out doing my set by trial and error. And the thing is, it's kind of sad to say, but the more I did comedy, the longer I did it, my whole thing of being like this weird act became more like conservative into a person just doing jokes.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
not like I was selling out because the jokes, I was at least doing the audience justice.
Yeah.
But my artistic side of just wanting to be a weird character, I kind of had dropped that just so that I could
but
do
you,
well.
But now you're starting to get into
yeah,
also,
I'm getting
you want to kill.
Yeah, exactly. at some point, you find that between killing and being yourself. There's like
That's
a fine
you
line, you know. So, but at least I was doing well now, and so I worked for 2 months, and then I did the finals, and I had a really good set. I killed, but I didn't win. Mo Mandel won.
Mo Mandel.
And so it was like, but it
but
was
then
like
you're hooked.
Yeah, but I was like, you know, I'm in it this far, and I kind of was standing outside in front after the show, and I was like, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And then this guy came up to me who's in the competition, this Indian guy, Tapan Trivedi, who killed, he got second place. And he was like, hey, man, are you religious? And I'm like, what kind of conversation is this motherfucker getting into?
Yeah.
I'm like, no. He's like, don't give me that Berkeley bullshit, man. If you have a religion, let me know, because I have a comedy tour, and we're each comedian of a different religion, and we're touring around. And I was like, all right, I'll check it out. I went online, and it was like Hindu, Muslim, a Jew, atheist, and a Christian. Doing this comedy tour. I'm like, oh, they don't have a Buddhist. I'm like, I called them, dude, I'm Buddhist. I didn't tell you, bro.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. So, I was the atheist on that tour.
So I did that. I joined that tour. I sent them the tape, and then I started working on Buddhist material.
Yep.
And to help do it at the same time, I was still on the speech and debate team. I did the next year. I went in again, ADS, the after dinner speaking. I did a speech on Buddhism. So I worked on my speech in the college speaking circuit, and then I worked on material in the clubs, and it was like I was able to get better faster that way.
Yeah, that's cool.
And I had this whole set which was like very self-deprecating, and I did it at like all these competitions. So I won the Rooster Teeth Feathers competition in Sunnyvale, and I won the San Jose Improv competition the next year. I went back and I won it.
That's dope.
So that was basically what got me, what like validated me. It was like, okay, I know my process. I can do this. And then I was like, it was like I looked back on the singing dream that I gave up. You know what I mean? I was like, I know what it's like to give up a dream once. This may not be my first choice. There may be something else out there better for me, but I'm not going to give up on this.
No, hell no. Me, I started music, but I knew I always should have been doing comedy.
Yeah, exactly.
But I just, in the neighborhood, there wasn't kids just doing comedy.
No, so you can't,
so
you can't just find it.
So I got in the band,
yeah.
and 25 years went by.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
I love rock more than anything.
Yeah.
And I think, thank God that I did that. To where I'm at now.
That's
you
so cool.
You know what I mean? Because I took the long way to get there.
Yeah.
But now I've got all this flavor. So you did your 1,000th spot. We did it together at Largo.
At Largo.
That was a magic night.
Oh, man. It was a legendary night. I mean, it was just, it worked out so nicely. There was this missing piece of the puzzle. I told you how depressed I was in the last bit of the streak.
Yeah.
And it was just like, things were so out of place. But then I was like, and where am I even going to do my 1,000th day? Does anybody even care?
Yeah.
Like, you know, the comedy store, they pulled the plug on my show.
Yeah.
I had a show there booked, so they pulled the plug on it, and I couldn't do it that anymore. Like, I wasn't getting a definite response from Laugh Factory. I ended up getting it, though. But basically, you came through with Largo.
Yeah.
And
well, you said, hey, I don't have a spot to do it. I said, Largo would be dope.
Yeah.
Because it's like, you know, a prestigious room.
Yeah, and if they didn't have anything booked for that night, you were able to get Bill Burr to sign for it.
Yeah,
and
Bill Burr made the call, man. Bill Burr is the reason it happened. He called and said, yeah, it's done deal. And then, man, we had a fucking almost a sellout show
there,
full theater.
It was great. It was a three-hour fucking show. I mean, we fucking beat that audience.
It was great, right? Yeah. Who we had? We had Kyle Kinane.
Kyle Kinane came open the show. He killed it.
He
stole the show.
We had Cedric Bixler
host.
It was awesome from the Mars Volta.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, and then me, then you. What a night it was!
It was
right?
a great night. It was
felt
a great
good.
Night.
And you had done Conan that day.
I had done Conan the 2 days before.
2 days before, yeah.
And then the next night, I did my 1,001, the final night in the San Francisco.
Punchline.
Sold out. I mean, probably the best show of the whole run, but. It was
Man.
It was such a cool experience, and
I got a great friend out of it. That's how I look at it.
Yeah,
that's
man.
How I look at comedy. You know what I mean? You go, look at these friends I've picked up along the way.
It's great. You really get to know. You don't get to know people like this in other industries. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you don't. It's great. Where can people find you?
Twitter, Sammy Obeid, SammyObeid. You can just Google my name and my blog comes up. I write a blog about different experiences in my life.
Yeah, yeah. It's great. They're great, too. They're really intricate. I love them a lot.
Thank you. Thank you.
You can tell that you're, you went to college.
Yeah.
When I read that.
I'm trying to portray what comedians go through to something that's both relatable to comedians, but also normal people can understand.
Yeah, read this because they're interested.
They should know what our life's going, you know, what's going on in our life, you know, and...
Trials and tribulations. Just life in the entertainment business.
But your case is very interesting because, like I said, my dream was always to be a rock. Like my dream was never to be a comedian. But I'm like, I'm in it now, and I know I would rather have this than most other things.
Right.
And we have a great profession. But then, like, you know, there's still something about me, like, always wondering what it would have been like if I stuck with music. And it's actually. Part of the reason I was so disillusioned a couple years ago at the end of the streak was so I got, you know, America's Got Talent. I didn't get that. They pulled the segment from the program.
Yep.
Around the same time, I went through a breakup and I was really disillusioned. And that was really bad. I was already in a really dark place and I was doing comedy right now. I was stressed out. All the pressure was building. But then one night, for some reason, I was like being sentimental about music, missing music. And I looked up Jimi Hendrix on Wikipedia.
Yeah.
And then I read it and said, Jimmy started playing guitar when he was 15 years old.
Oh, you were lied to.
I was like,
yeah, you were lied to.
Who told me four?
Yeah.
Where did they get that from?
And you could have stuck with it.
I could have I started when I was 11.
I would have been better than Hendrix.
I would have outlived him. I'm 30 now. You know what I mean? I would be 7 years better than Hendrix right now.
We'll wrap it up on this, but you know what when I knew that I should be a comedian was every fucking day. People would go, you'd play a gig, a crushing gig, and they'd go, man, you should be a comedian.
Really?
Because I'd be kind of funny in between songs whatever. And backstage, I would be telling stories. And it would eat me alive because I'd be like, hey, motherfucker, I just opened for Wilco.
Yeah, right, right. You what about my music?
Hey,
what
man,
about my
Tom
voice?
Petty, man. I just opened for Tom, you know what I mean? Like, what about my records, you know?
Wow.
And they're like, no. Don't get me wrong. Your music's great, but you're so much fun, you know?
Yeah.
So the whole time... It was always there in my face.
That's,
you know,
crazy, man.
So now I it doesn't even matter if I ever do anything in comedy. I'm just doing it and I love it.
Totally, man.
That's what it's about.
Totally, man. We should
start the end of the day, man.
We should start a band though too.
I think it'd be fantastic. Me, you, and Burr.
Yeah, man.
And we'll get Andrew Thim, unless you play bass, because Thim could just play guitar.
I'm happy to play bass.
Yeah, yeah.
Any kind of guitar.
Yeah. And then in between songs, we tell terrible jokes.
Yeah, man, totally. We are all. It could be B sides and fucking
some
hot music.
First jokes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Oh man,
that would be great, man. I'm down anytime.
Well, I love you, man. Thanks for being on.
Thank you for having me, man. This was fantastic.
Yeah, and please, people, go see Sam. He's fantastic. Look at his clip, Conan clip. I think you can see it on Conan's website still, maybe.
Yeah, just you could Google Sammy Obeid. The Conan thing should come up.
And
YouTube,
watch for the movie. What's it going to be called?
The movie, I think we're just going to call it 1,000 Days of Comedy, but we don't have an exact release date, but I'm hoping for it to come out in November. We're working on the trailer tonight.
Yeah, so. Am I in the trailer?
You very well might, but you're in a lot of footage.
Well,
did I tell you we're thinking about releasing it in episodes possibly?
That's right.
One episode is the day we went to Conan, which largely you're in a lot of scenes there. You know what I mean? And we got some good interviews with you from other points in the streak.
Yeah.
So you're definitely going to make an appearance.
That's great. I love you, man.
Yeah.
All right. There he is. Thanks, guys, for tuning in. Sammy Obeid. Thank you, guys. See you
Thank
later.
Thank you all. All right.